You're listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast, where we shine light on the dark side of Christianity and how it affects people and communities. I'm Robin Mitchell Stroud, and I'm here with my co-host, Deborah Levy Martinelli. We'll be covering a variety of topics, from individual survivor stories, including our own, to the influence of religion on our national politics. To learn more about the podcast, visit our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or connect with us on TikTok and Instagram at The Incarcerated Christian, and on Twitter at @TICC_podcast_. Now, on to the show.
Our guest today is Dr. Kyle Harper. Dr. Harper is the G.T. and Libby Blankenship Chair in the History of Liberty, Professor of Classics and Letters, and Provost Emeritus at the University of Oklahoma. An historian of the ancient world and particularly ancient Rome, his work spans economic, environmental, and social history. He has written four books: Slavery in the Late Roman World AD, which was awarded the James Henry Breasted Prize for the American Historical Association and the Outstanding Publication Award from the Classical Association of the Middle West and South; From Shame to Sin, the Christian Transformation of Sexual Morality, which we'll be talking about in a moment, which won the award for Excellence in the Study of Religion in Historical Studies from the American Academy of Religion; The Fate of Rome, Climate, Disease, and the End of an Empire, which has been translated into 12 languages; and Plagues Upon the Earth, A Global History of the Interplay Between Human Social Development and Infectious Diseases, spanning from our human and human-like ancestors to the present. Dr. Harper earned a bachelor's degree in letters from the University of Oklahoma, graduating summa cum laude. He also holds master's and doctoral degrees in history from Harvard University. He has served on the OU faculty since 2007 and was the university's Norman Campus Senior Vice President and Provost for 6 years. He currently serves as Senior Advisor to the President and teaches a range of courses on classical antiquity and early Christianity. It sounds so weird to call you Dr. Harper, but welcome, Kyle Harper. We're excited to have you here.
Welcome.
Great to see you all.
Oh, you too. And we have to tell our listeners that we know you from your time as the provost at the University of Oklahoma. So we worked with you on more, you know, administrative projects. But we admired your scholarship from afar. I mean, you've never stopped being a scholar. And on a personal note, our elder son, August, has taken classes with you.
I think it is in one currently.
And he, oh my gosh, he cannot say enough good things about you and your teaching. You are definitely like top of the list. So it's kind of fun to hear him come home and actually tell stories about what you all have been talking about in class.
That's a huge compliment. And I get reports on the household conversations sometimes too. I heard there's a rotten debate between the Stoics and the Epicureans, and I'm trying to give them some ammo. So.
Oh, you're the Epicurean side of things?
No, but I want him to beat you all in the argument.
Oh, well, he's very good. He probably doesn't need that help, but he's probably tucking it away. No, actually, that's so good. I love to hear you say that, Kyle. What he really likes about your teaching is your storytelling, which I assume we're going to get a little flavor of that today, which will be fun. So, Kyle, you don't know this, but when we started this podcast last year, you were on our short list of people we wanted to talk to because of that book. I've got it right here in front of me. From Shame to Sin, The Christian Transformation of Sexual Morality in Late Antiquity. Dying to talk to you about that, but you were on sabbatical. You can't bother somebody when they're on sabbatical.
You must be the only person who thinks that you can't bother someone on sabbatical. You would have told everyone else.
Well, it feels wrong to bother somebody when they're on sabbatical.
Yeah, I agree, and I appreciate your restraint.
Well, we patiently waited for this year, and thank you for agreeing to be a guest. Now, listen, the reason. So we have you here to talk about this, and you are an historian of Christian sexual morality, and sex and sexuality is such a big part of the experience of being what we call an incarcerated Christian, purity culture and all of that stuff. And sex and sexuality is really weaponized, and particularly against girls and women, but I don't think it's healthy for boys and men either. So one of the things that always bothered me about the church that I grew up in is nobody could tell me the history of how we got to where we were on a multitude of topics. And this is that little piece, missing piece for me on at least, this transformation around sex and sexuality in the early Christian world, and then how that carries forward to today. So that's a very long-winded intro to get you to explain why we have you here and why we're so excited to have you here.
Well, thanks. I will warn you that I published that book in 2013. So it was, I have to try and remember what I said.
We're going to talk big themes. Believe me, I was telling Deborah, I cannot go into the weeds. Like, I wish I had a whole semester with you on this book, but just talking the big themes and we might be able to help with that just from some of our own notes.
Okay, good. I might have to go back and study some of this.
I don't think so. I think it's going to come right off the top of your, you're just going to be popping. Did you grow up Christian?
Yes, I did.
What is your religious background? Which church and where? And
We grew up Southern Baptist. Oh, yes. And had a very good church community. And then my wife grew up Southern Baptist as well, but we both are probably a little more Catholic, and we haven't got all the way to Rome, but we're Episcopalian.
That's what but, I am. You know, at least
up along the way.
Oh, yeah. I love that you called yourself a little more Catholic.
Yeah.
Catholic light, right? Catholic light.
Definitely a small C Catholic for sure.
I gotcha. Well, Deborah, it looks like you had a question. Do you?
I was just going to ask, this is a major jump, but I was going to ask, 2013 is a given, but what gave you the idea for this particular book? Why did you write this book?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good question. My doctoral dissertation, which is honestly very boring. You know, you have to do a piece of very technical scholarship to make your initial contribution. There's good things and bad things about that, actually, but you should do a very well-defined piece of original scholarship. It's kind of your first thing. And so when I was in graduate school, I started working on slavery in the later Roman period. So that's kind of the third, fourth, fifth century, which is, to me, that's the period that I specialize in. It's obviously, I think it's one of the most fascinating periods in human history. You've got Romans, you've also got Christians, and the Christians go from being the persecuted minority to kind of unexpectedly the dominant majority. So it's a really interesting period, and I'm really mostly kind of an economic historian, and I got very interested in the question of slavery in that period. And partly you're just looking for something desperately as a grad student where you think not everything has been said. And certainly when you're a grad student, I at least was paranoid that everything that could ever be said had been said about the Romans. I actually feel less that way the more I know, but the topic of slavery seemed like one where there was a lot to study, a lot of material, a lot to work with, stuff that hadn't been really given the level of attention that you might expect. And so there are just a lot of like Christian sermons and sources that had kind of fallen between the cracks to talk about the question of slavery in this period. So I wrote a dissertation on that. That became my first book, which was published in 2011, I think you said. I have to look it up. called Slavery in the Late Roman World. It is probably not my most exciting piece of writing, but it is a, I think, better version of the dissertation. But when I wrote that, I found all this stuff about sex and sexual ethics that is a little bit in that first book, but just really wasn't given the space that it needed. And it was really getting at different questions. So I had all this material left over, and ultimately it was more than enough for a shorter book on a kind of big topic. But it was immediately after finishing the book on slavery, I wanted to write a book about sex and Christianity, and then particularly kind of the social history, and we can get more into that. But I came at it from that angle. So it was sort of the extra book that came out a lot of my really first phase of research.
So you mentioned that social history. Do you want to get into that now? Because that's a big part of the how major it was, right? This shift from, maybe we should talk about from shame to sin first. When I first saw that title, I was so taken by it because my experience included both shame and sin, but more like toxic shame. And what you mean by shame is something very different. It's not like a hammer where you're hammering people with shame, like shame upon you, right? Do you want to talk about what you mean by shame or what you found about shame in that time period?
Yeah. And the title's just a title. I kind of like the title.
I love it.
It's catchy.
Yeah.
But I've also caught some flack because I mean these words in very particular ways as just sort of shorthand for talking about a system of sexual morality before Christian times and a system that emerges because of Christianization. So I really use them in that very particular sense. And it's sort of the argument of the whole book is about what that means.
Exactly. So yes.
It's not maybe totally as self-evident as the title might.
It was to me. Did these people who were critical of it, did they read your book?
I always think my critics haven't actually read my book. That's what authors think.
Very clear.
But by shame, I mean something particular. I mean this. It's very hard for us, and by this us, I just mean anybody who lives in the 21st century, particularly in a Western culture that's been shaped by 2,000 years of Christianity, to sort of unpick how the ways in which Christianity has shaped our thinking about everything. And that's one of the challenges, but also one of the alluring things about studying Greco-Roman antiquity is you're exploring this very different cultural world. And, you know, at first assumption, you know, you shouldn't assume that it's a better or worse world. It's definitely some of both. And we have to start by getting rid of what we maybe think we know and going back to the kinds of assumptions that they actually make about the world, about human nature, about what's right and wrong, about societies and individuals. And in Greco-Roman antiquity, there was far less interest in the kind of freedom of the individual to make their own choices. And in the particular domain of sex, the rules and values of that Greco-Roman world are what I would call very embedded in the fabric of society. And so they don't sort of start from the assumption of the individual making voluntary choices about right and wrong. They start from the city or the society and its need to regenerate itself generation after generation. And the way that sexual ideas get formed is really inseparable from, it's embedded in the kind of moral order of society itself. And that means that the kinds of social relationships, power relationships that are inherent in that society, which was a very hierarchical society. And again, it's one where, you know, we live in a hierarchical society in some ways. We don't live in a world where people are equal, but our inequality tends to be much more informal, like economic, say wealth is maybe the most obvious expression. And we live in a world where everyone is, you know, legally equal, free and equal. And so you have to think your way back to a world where that is just a completely alien concept, where there is a status hierarchy that is legal, formal, forced by the state, where some people are free and some people are slave and some people are in between, where men and women have very different rights and responsibilities, where adults and children, where insiders and outsiders have very different rights and responsibilities. And so when I say shame, I mean a whole system of thinking about sexual ethics that is embedded in a world of the city, of the public system and a world that is very, very sharply hierarchical and with very patriarchal differences between men and women. And so I like to say, and I say this in the book, you know, we sometimes talk about the double standard in sexual morality, that there are different expectations of men and women. And, you know, that generally means that for men, sexual morality is kind of a small deal and they can have more freedom to have sex with different people. Whereas for women, it's a big deal. And if they transgress expectations, it's considered a bigger deal. So we talk about the double standard, right? The different rules and sort of different severity level that our society imposes expectations on men and women. In the ancient world, I don't even think it's appropriate to talk of the double standard because that implies that there's something like duplicitous about it. There's just, for men in the Greek and Roman world, there's just a completely different system of rules than there are for women. There's not even any grounds for the notion that they might be bound by the same set of rules. And so, you know, you can call it a double standard, but it's really just two completely different sets of standards. And they often talk about the violation of these standards in terms of shame. And so for men, there are definitely some rules. They tend to be much lighter and fewer than the rules for women. And if those are transgressed, it's considered shameful. And there are very strong expectations and limits for women. And if those are transgressed, they're certainly considered shameful. So that's a very long-winded way that I think even only starts to kind of get at what I'm talking about by the word shame.
Kyle, can you give us some examples of what those rules were for men and for women?
Yeah. So they may not even think of them as a system of rules. And even that's a kind of challenging way to say what it is you're talking about. What is the framework that they have? For men, it's generally a code of masculinity. And that means that men are expected to be dominant. And they're by and large, you know, one thing you're not allowed to do is to violate another man's wife. And it is considered a kind of violation, almost like, you know, this isn't quite how they would usually say it, but sort of transgressing on their property. But you're dishonoring another man by violating either any of the women that are sort of part of his household honor, whether that's a wife or a freeborn daughter. And so it's interesting, one way to really get at the kind of logic and how strange and alien it is in our world is to just pay close attention to the Latin here. And I promise I'm not going to make sex boring with too much.
I don't think this is boring at all.
the Latin word, and here my classical historical training is guiding me, but the Latin word adulterium is where we get our word adultery, but it's almost what, you know, the French would call une fausse amie, a fake friend, because the seeming identity of the words actually will lead you astray. So this is not, their adulterium is really not the same thing as our adultery. We think of adultery, the kind of vernacular meaning of that in English today, is a very, very Christianized word. Whether you're Christian or not, if you use the word adultery in English, you're reflecting thousands of years of Christian influence. If by adultery you mean sex that is a betrayal of a marriage promise between a husband and wife. For the Romans, Latin adulterium means the violation of another man's wife. It's more like our word adulterate, to pollute something, and particularly means to pollute some other guy's wife. And so the Roman law, which punishes adulterium, is never punishing a husband for sort of infidelity per se. It is only a law that protects men against the violation of their wives by other men. So it's a false friend. It's a word that seems so close and it's like right there, but there is such a world of radical transformation between the idea that adulterium is polluting another man's wife and adultery is infidelity to a marriage covenant. So pretty amazing, like how much, you know, is required to really think about the changing meaning of that one word. And one of the cool things I was able to get at is actually you can see in my period, and I'm not sure there'd been as much investigation of this as you might think, but you can actually see these Christian leaders, and the same actually is true in Greek, the words moikia, but it has the same transformation. In classical Greek, it means violating some dude's female betrothed property, sort of. And in Christian Greek, it means betrayal of a marriage covenant. So you can actually see in the later Roman period that I study on, you can actually see people explicitly grappling with the changing language. And they talk about, you think this means this, but maybe it really means this. And so you can actually follow that linguistic transformation. But behind the changing meaning of the words is this whole changing of the system, of the logic. So going back to, I got a little bit off on the rules. You know, for men, the main rule was you better not touch some other man's women, whether it's his wives or daughters. There were slightly different words for violating people's daughters. That was a different, it wasn't adultery. It was called like stuprum, outrage, or oh, there's a better word for it. Anyway, you know, outraging a man's daughter. And it was, those are both punishable crimes. And the other kind of system of expectations comes around masculinity. So this gets, not to get too graphic, but it really involves like expectations about the body. And Roman men are not expected to be penetrated, but it doesn't particularly matter who they penetrate with their bodies. So again, it's just like completely different language is just embedded in their basic understanding of terms and rules. For women, the rules are really pretty simple. Sex is reserved for marriage and the reproduction of legitimate children. And again, one of the ways to really understand how radically different this is that the definition of marriage in Roman antiquity is a relationship for the reproduction of legitimate children. So we think of marriage, and we probably think we as big, we think of it in different ways. But I think, you know, there are common cultural conceptions of marriage as a partnership, as a relationship of love, as a sort of way of forming a family and of having kids, possibly. But for the Romans, that's what marriage is. It's the relationship in which a man and woman are pacted in a way that they will produce legitimate offspring who will inherit the property. Now we could go into this too, because it's actually interesting. I want to give some credit to the Greeks and Romans. They also have sort of new ideas of love, and you actually see new kinds of literature celebrating, you know, two people falling in love and really mutually loving each other. These are actually called the romances, and it's where, you know, we get our sense of romance. So it's not all so bleak. They have some conception that spouses will love each other, and they might even get married because they sort of like each other. So, you know, their society, their world is as complicated as ours. But legally and structurally, they think of marriage as a relationship for the production of legitimate children. And deeply embedded in that is the expectation that women come to marriage as virgins. And we also have to remember always the age structure of marriage in these worlds. This is a world where women marry young in the Mediterranean, probably at like 16, plus or minus. Men marry late, you know, variation, but mid-20s to late 20s. So there's a long stretch of time relative to puberty, longer for men than women. So women marry very, very young. They're generally, just practically speaking, still likely within a nuclear household with maybe one or both of their parents alive in many cases. So marriage is often sort of an agreement with a girl's father. Although the Romans have, and you know, again, we can see this as something important. They have the concept that the marriage has to be consensual. And so both the husband and wife have to consent to the marriage, which not all pre-modern cultures have had. And that's a that ends up being also a very important influence and very enduring influence, that marriage has to be consensual with both parties. But in practice, of course, you know, women are very young when they're married, and they're expected to be virgins when they marry and to be chaste within marriage. Whereas men are, you know, expected not to violate other men's wives, which is a much, much different set of rules.
That I was going to say, you're describing a system that I was raised in. So from that standpoint, not much has changed. So like expectation for chastity, purity, being a virgin when you get married. But if a man sort of is not that way coming into a marriage, okay. You know, ideally he would be, but like the shame isn't the same. When did this system start to change from shame to sin? I found this interesting because one is an emphasis on the collective and the other is an emphasis on the individual, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when did that start to change?
Yeah. I mean, you can, it's a great question. And
it's a whole class. It's a whole semester long class.
The book even isn't enough to really cover it.
But,
as many of my critics like to point out, but you know, you have to try and say when do the big changes happen and why.
Mm-hmm. And that why is really important, right?
And there it is. And there are always major changes. And the Roman culture was changing even before Christianization. And that's a really interesting question. You know, was it going in directions that Christianity is kind of riding the currents, or does Christianity sort of disrupt the direction? And they're smart reasons to believe both, but I think it's more of the latter, that it's a really important redirection of the course of the history of ethics. And I think a lot of it really originates from the New Testament, at least the pieces of it that we can see. And certainly in my scholarship, I've really put front and center a very important term and set of ideas that go around it, that in the Greek is porneia, and is a very hard word to translate. It's so hard to translate that there's not actually a Latin word for it. So already when they're making the Latin Bible, they basically in antiquity have to kind of contrive a word, and the word they contrive is fornicatio. And so it's where we get our word fornication. That's not a bad strategy. There's not a right or wrong way to encapsulate it in one word, but we have to ask what did this word mean? Because it's very central to what happens. And probably the most impactful passage in this change from shame to sin is in the New Testament book of 1 Corinthians, which is a letter, or possibly pieces of letters written by the Apostle Paul in the first century, mid-first century. And he says, chapters 5-7 are really important. He says, particularly in chapter 7, he says that Christians should flee fornication. So this word porneia keeps appearing in these really central chapters. And what's interesting is that you can tell from this part of Corinthians that there were people on sort of both ends of the possible extremes. And they honestly wanted to know, they thought they were interpreting things right, and they wanted to know what Paul thought. And some of them clearly were very, what we often say in the sort of scholarly literature, libertine, in the fact that they believed that the kind of freedom that Paul had talked about from the law had meant that the kind of sexual rules were now sort of dissolved. And you see this, Paul actually quotes this point of view by saying, some of you are saying that all things are now permissible. And then you have people who believed like the exact opposite. You see this at the beginning of chapter 7, where Paul says, some of you are saying that it's good for a man not even to touch a woman. In other words, that all sex is off limits. And throughout the early Christian church, they're actually, this whole spectrum of opinion is at least somewhere represented. There are people who defend the libertine position. That doesn't seem to have been very prominent. What is much more of a major option is the extreme, what we usually call encratite position, which is just scholars making something difficult, meaning extreme rejection of sexuality, that there is no legitimate, there's no place for sexuality. And it's a complicated view that's often associated with Gnostic forms of Christianity that can be very world rejecting. So many of these encratite Christians seem to have really rejected the physical world and believed that the human being is really the eternal soul, the immaterial soul that is trapped in the prison of a body, to go to your incarceration. I know you like incarceration metaphors.
I do actually.
So that's one that's an important one for the Gnostics. And they're drawing from ancient philosophy, from Platonism and Neoplatonism, to come to some very, very ascetic views that say that everyone should live without sex, because sex is part of our entrapment, imprisonment in the body, and part of our imprisonment in this hopelessly irredeemable physical world. That's a world of corruption. It's a world of evil. It's a world that was created by evil cosmic powers, and that we need to save ourselves from. Whether that's exactly what the people Paul's quoting thought or not, it's clear that already in the mid-first century, he's talking to people who say you should never, ever have any sex. And there's probably also, I don't want to get too far off, there are probably also connections or overlap between that view and very strong apocalyptic expectations. So some people may have thought that the world was ending. And so they're not thinking, you know, what's going to be the rules for the next two centuries or whatever. They're thinking, what are going to be the rules for the next 2 months until the new age is brought on? Now, not all Gnostics are radical imminent apocalypticists and vice versa. But there's this whole mix of ideas at play. And all we know is that Paul encountered both of these points of view. And points of view by people who were within the Christian, the early Christian community. He's not talking here to Greek pagans, which he does do, and the early Christians do. He's not talking to Roman emperors or philosophers. He's talking to people within the very small early Christian community who are trying to figure this out. And part of Paul's answer, for me, a really important part, is that he says, don't flee fornication. So don't participate in porneia. And again, to me as a historian, this is exciting. And I'm a economic social historian, not a theologian or New Testament scholar. What I can hope to add as a scholar is just a sense of the social world and the social lives of the people whose words we're reading, whose ideas have an influence, and to try empathetically to understand, you know, what is life like in an ancient city like Corinth? And part of that is language. What does it mean when Paul says flee fornication? And so,
yeah, what did he mean?
Well, scholars are still debating this, and I haven't convinced everyone yet, but I surely will in the long run, because I'm right. What's interesting is porne. So the Greek word porne is the word for prostitute. And what's really interesting, and I think no one I've showed this to a point that even people who don't agree with me would probably, unless they're just being really, really obtuse, say this is right, that in pre-Christian Greek, in classical Greek, first of all, the word porneia is almost never used. So it's that in itself is really cool and interesting and weird and requires some thinking. And it's kind of like, I mean, again, people who work on the New Testament sometimes don't always have the same depth of knowledge of ancient culture and thought and language. And it's actually the same, almost the same thing with the word agape, which is love, and which is the central word of New Testament ethics over and over again, and is a really weird word. It's not common at all outside of Christian Greek. And so it's really interesting to think about, you know, what do these words mean to them and where are they getting this? And it really does emphasize that the moral system that's emerging is so different that it sometimes even requires different language. And so it's kind of true as well for porneia. The Jews in the ancient Mediterranean, many of whom are Greek speaking in Greek and Roman times into the Roman Empire, when they're speaking Greek, they are the ones who start using the word porneia. When the classical Greeks do use it, it means prostitution from the prostitute's point of view. So it means to basically to sell oneself, to sell one's body. When the Jews, and then particularly when the Christians use it, it means something very, very different. They're not saying don't sell your body. They're saying something almost closer to don't be the one who buys a woman's body. And I think it's a little wider than that, but we should always remember that early Christians who spoke Greek, when they heard porneia, would have never been able to not hear prostitute. And it's a really harsh word. I mean, it's something like whore. And, you know, this isn't a perfect analogy, but like whoring or something is closer to what porneia means.
When used by the early Christians.
When used by the early Christians.
Not the prostitutes.
Not by the Greeks who mean it from the sense of selling your body. And so we have to remember in the social world in Corinth in the first century, you have two very different sets of moral standards for men and women. And you have very different sets of moral standards and legal standards for who can do what to whom. And masters have complete legal and moral claims to the bodies of their enslaved persons. So to a way that's even hard for us to mentally grasp, I think, the Greco-Roman system was inseparable from slavery. And the slave system is inseparable from the sexual economy, from the sex trade. And this is all legal. I mean, Vegas probably doesn't even capture, or Amsterdam, or any places where there is a licit sexual economy, doesn't even, I think, begin to conjure for us the pervasiveness of a world where there are brothels everywhere. We know this from Pompeii. There are brothels everywhere, and there are slaves everywhere. And what porneia means, I argue, we have to try to account for the social environment in which these languages worked, in which people lived and experienced. And it's a world where what we would call exploitation is legal, and not just that, but it's actually expected and approved. And so in some sense, flee fornication has to be saying, you know, leave that system, that world behind, where people are, enslaved, and where men can do whatever they want. That, to me, that word is really caught up in the social matrix. So that's kind of how I got there from slavery, and had all this role that I wanted to keep exploring. But I think it's a case where we can learn a lot about the New Testament world, the texts, and the world in which they emerged from knowing about the social history of the Roman Empire, the Mediterranean in Roman times.
So how do you see that transformation carrying forward to today? Or do you think about that? I mean, that's a big question. And also you're an historian of antiquity.
My area of expertise. I'm painting in broad strokes just to go down to the fourth century or so. What I find, so I'll say one thing that I think I'd like to get in about how all this plays out is that, the early Christian church is sort of, from that moment on, is in this in-between position where it will stake out a position between the extremes of kind of Gnostic rejection of the world, and with that rejection of the physical body and the reproduction of society, to, at the other end, the more libertine position. And so, in a lot of ways, the rest of the book is about how in constantly changing circumstances, different Christian thinkers who will have a long influence. So like St. Augustine, he's dealing with actually in a lot of ways the same conversation that Paul is. Now, his world is very different. He's in North Africa. He's in the later empire. He's at a time when the world is becoming majority Christian, but he's still sitting there trying to figure out what that means in his world, for his flock, for him as a bishop. And by steering the middle ground, the early church it's not Gnostic. So Orthodox early Christianity is not world rejecting, you know, and this is pervasive throughout the New Testament, from ideas about the physical resurrection of Christ to the idea that the Judeo-Christian God is the creator of the physical universe, that is inherently good and is redeemable. And that really comes to shape ideas about sex and marriage, and to provide a positive place for even for the body in Christian thought. But at the same time, it's a system that rejects the kind of most exploitative elements of the ancient slave system, and does affirm some of the stronger elements of consensual voluntary marriage. And so that will particularly play out in the Middle Ages, where that becomes really, really important for Christian marriage, that it's consensual. But all of these, you know, ideas play out over and over again over centuries. And I think it's resonant that you can say that, you know, in our times, these are still questions and hard issues that people grapple with. And in some ways, the language of shame that existed in Greek and Roman times, it never, ever goes away. And so in some sense, it's maybe better to think of this completely new system that's laid on top of this old system and interacts with it, reinforces it in certain ways, and undermines it in certain ways. I think that's one of the parts of the story that doesn't always get told, is it does undermine it. I mean, it's why we could never think of adultery in the simple Roman terms. We struggle to really understand what the word porneia or fornication means, because we struggle, you know, we couldn't imagine, I think, a society where the kind of systemic exploitation — it's not that we're innocent of exploitation, but I think it's still meaningful to recognize that if you walked around a Greco-Roman city, we would be, I think, morally shocked and offended at the ways in which slavery in particular was so embedded in the way they operated, the way they saw the world, the way they thought about right and wrong, in ways that for us, I think, are violations of human dignity and basic freedom. So I do think that there's an interesting story in the way that plays out over the centuries in which Christianity becomes dominant, but wouldn't want to say that old system ever just goes away.
Well, and as I was listening to you talk, I was picturing the brothels in Pompeii, because been there, seen the murals, the menu.
Yeah.
And this shift from shame to sin, did the brothels become like, did they go underground? Clearly they haven't disappeared, right? It's just that with the focus being on sin.
I don't know. I don't know. I have to.
You're so funny. Well, we're still talking about them.
We're still talking about them. It definitely, I mean, go underground. That's not a bad way to put it. But again, as a historian, what's, you know, how do you talk about change? That's pretty complicated.
Yeah, because we didn't get to half of the things in your, not even.
I know.
Free will, just like all of these things.
But I have to answer this question, because I find it so important and fascinating that, like, there's something about walking around Pompeii and, like you say, Sid, seeing the menu and, you know, a lot of these ancient erotic depictions, frescoes and mosaics are like in people's living rooms and stuff. There's a kind of frankness that's so culturally ancient that is changed. But going underground is not a bad metaphor, because it really is above ground in Roman times, and it's taxed. I mean, it's an important source of revenue for the state, and this doesn't happen at once, but progressively, generation after generation, that kind of overt systemic exploitation becomes less and less feasible. The state stops taxing it. Eventually, the state does create laws that punish putting enslaved women into prostitution. So these are really changes that you can talk about and that are, you know, traceable. They happen. And so the sex trade never goes away. But it doesn't have the place in medieval and early modern societies, cities, that it does in antiquity, for the most part, although you can find definite exceptions.
And the ideas of honor around sex and sexuality, they may be different. The ideas of honor, you know, yeah, like the idea of honor around sex and sexuality is still very much alive and well, even if it just operates sort of differently in society. Still very, very controlling of people.
And this is where the title maybe requires some important explanation, you know, from shame to sin. Maybe it's from shame to shame plus sin, or
right.
But I think you know, the way these moral systems work does change.
Yeah.
And there's sort of this maybe two-level system that can compete or reinforce one another. But yeah, I wouldn't want to say that the ideas, the entanglements of ideas about honor and shame ever sort of get extinguished in the classical world, in the Mediterranean. There's some really deep continuities there too.
I have to come in now with my velvet hammer before you guys get me in trouble with time here. This is my job, Kyle.
Yeah, she keeps us on track.
I try. What that you have fast. Told us today, I know it was just under an hour, and we have so much more that we would like to talk to you about sometime.
So grateful for your book, though. It your book was so helpful to me just as a person trying to understand my current experience and how that evolved historically, and not being able to get answers within my church. You know, it's like, so your book is just really helpful. So thank you, Kyle Harper.
I appreciate that. It's not every day historians get to do anything useful or helpful. And it really was. It was kind of I sometimes like to say I wrote about a book about the history of sex and lived to tell about it, and I'll never do it again. It really is. It was a one-time excursion for me. I'm glad I did it. I think there's something valuable there. But it's not really my sort of central
specialty.
Focus as a scholar. I'm more of an economic, social, and now environmental guy. But yeah, it was, I'm moved and honored that you liked it and found something helpful there. But yeah, I lived to tell about it. I won't do it again.
Too much backlash.
And look how much you remembered after 9 years.
I know, yeah, you did well.
It comes back. It's in there somewhere.
Yeah. Now, Deborah, we're not going to leave before you ask our closer question, are you?
No, we are not.
Okay, good.
This is something that we ask every guest, Kyle, and that is, what is your favorite spiritual practice? And you can define spiritual however you like.
Want. Yeah.
Spiritual practice? what a great question. And I love the old prayer book, High Church Liturgy. I love language. I love English. And, you know, I'm sure not everybody has to agree. This is partly aesthetic, but to me, there's just something beautiful about the kind of permanence of certain liturgies, that can never be replaced. So
you've got the Book of Common Prayer. You've got the Book of Common Prayer, like handy.
And the old one.
And the old one. Oh, you've got the old one. Okay.
Yeah.
So,
of course,
Kyle,
he's an antiquities historian.
I know. That should have been a given. But Kyle, I find that very comforting too, just to know that those, you know, have been repeated many, many years by many, many people. Yeah. I like that.
Kyle, cool. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah. Thank you so much. So good to see you.
Yeah, great to see you all, and it's worked out great.
Thank you for listening to the Incarcerated Christian Podcast. We invite you to rate and review our show, And remember, you can find this interview and others on our website, theincarceratedchristian.com, or anywhere you access podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us on Instagram and TikTok at The Incarcerated Christian and on Twitter at @TCPodcast_. You can find more information about us and our show on our website. Again, that's theincarceratedchristian.com. Until next time, go forth in love and light.